in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, and the fact that Jews are now sovereign over their land, over our land, and specifically over Yerushalayim. Why is it exactly that we continue to fast? Stories are told about fast days after the Six-Day War, and how there was a group of Orthodox academics in Israel who on Shiva Sar B'Tammuz, I believe, following the Six-Day War, sat and, you know, went to the Kotel and drank L'chaim. They had a, they said, you don't have to fast anymore. It's, we're sovereign over the land. There's no need to fast. So what exactly is the halacha? Do we continue to fast indefinitely? Or is there a, will there be a point in the time where we stop fasting? And if so, what is that point in time? So sort of the halachic parameters of the fast days, Tisha B'Av, and then the minor fasts which are associated with Tisha B'Av, meaning not Tanis Esther or anything like that, but the ones that are associated with the destruction of the temple. Those are laid out in the Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah on page 1 of the source packet. I have more source packets on here, so you cannot see. Amar Rav Chana Bar Bizna Amar Rabbi Shimon Chasida. Mai dechsiv ko amar Hashem Tzvakos Tzom HaRevi'i V'Tzom HaChamishi V'Tzom HaShevi'i V'Tzom HaAsiri Yehle Beis Yehuda L'Sason U'L'Simcha. The prophet Zechariah says that these fast days are going to change into Sason and Simcha. So let's just go through them. Tzom HaRevi'i, that's Shiva Sar B'Tammuz. Tzom HaChamishi, that's Tisha B'Av. Tzom HaShvi'i is Tzom Gedalia, because it's in Tishrei, Shvi'i being the seventh. Each one is referring to the month on the calendar in which the fast takes place. V'Tzom HaAsiri is Asara B'Teves. Those are the four fasts that are associated with the destruction of the temple. So according to the prophet Zechariah, at some point they're all going to turn into days of joy and happiness. So the Gemara asks, Kari Lahutz, we're now on the fifth line of the Gemara, the first word on the line is Kari. Kari Lahutzom, V'Kari Lahu Sason V'Simcha. The prophet calls it both a fast, a tzom, and it also calls it sason v'simcha, joy and happiness. So what's the deal? Bizman sheyesh shalom, yiyu l'sason u'l'simcha. When there is peace, that's when there are going to be joy and happy times. Ein shalom, tzom. But if there's no peace, then it's a fast. What do you think? What do you think? What?
There's no peace.
No peace. So nowadays there's no peace, so maybe there's still fasts. Okay. Anyone else? What? One thing that's interesting is that it doesn't say milchama tzom, right? It says bizman sheyesh shalom, it's happy. Ein shalom, it's a fast. It doesn't say that if there's a war, it's a fast. It just says that if there's no peace, there's a fast. So it's a little bit more broad in terms of when it would be a fast. There you go, Marjorie. Sure. It's broader as to when it would be a fast. Okay, so that's the first step. So the next thing is, Amar Rav Papa, Hachi Ke'amar. Bizman Sheyesh Shalom. So Rav Papa disagrees with the original Gemara. Either he disagrees with it, or he expands upon it and limits it a little bit. And he actually says there are three categories. We originally had two categories. Peace, they're happy. No peace, they're fast days. Rav Papa says there are three categories. Halachika Amar. Bezman sheyesh shalom, yulas ason v'simcha. There's peace, fine. There'll be happy times. Yesh gzeiras ha-malchus, tzom. If there is a government decree against the Jews, that's when they're a fast day. Specifically, if there is something, there's anti-Semitism in the government. That's when they're fast days. Ein zeiras malchus ve'ein shalom. What if there is neither peace nor an anti-Semitic decree? It's just, neither one. In that case, ratzu meta'anin, ratzu ein meta'anin. There's that ratzu again. If they want to fast, they can fast. And if they don't want to fast, they don't have to fast. Means the fast is optional. I hachi tisha be'av nami. If so, then that should also all apply to tisha be'av, to the ninth of Av. Meaning not just to the three minor fasts, but also to this more major fast. Amar of Papa, Shani Tisha B'Av, Ho'il V'Huchpilu Bo Tzarot. Says Tisha B'Av is different from Asara B'Teves and Tzom Gedalia and Shiva Asar B'Tamuz, because there were many, many things that happened on Tisha B'Av. Never mind that many things also happened on Shiva Asar B'Tamuz, according to the Mishnah, but Rav Papa says many things happened on Tisha B'Av, and so we don't continue fasting on Tisha B'Av, even when the other fasts become optional. Okay, so that's sort of the baseline for the halacha. Either the fasts are all obligatory, or they all turn into Yom Tov, into Sason v'Simcha, or Tisha B'Av remains mandatory, but the three minor fasts become optional. So the big question is, what is defined as shalom? How do you know? What does it mean that there is shalom? According to Rashi, I think we would all be celebrating today. Look at the Rashi on the top left side. Sheyesh shalom, what's the definition of Zman Sheyesh shalom? She'ein yad ha'ovdei kochavim tekefa al Yisrael. When it's not the case that non-Jews are sovereign in Israel, meaning when Jews are sovereign in the land of Israel, that is considered a Zman Sheyesh shalom.
Love it.
Make Kiddush on Erev Tisha B'Av. That is also the view of the Meiri. Take a look on page 2. The Meiri. The Meiri says, Ketzad, where I marked with the arrow on top. Ketzad v'zman sheyesh shalom. What is considered a time when there is peace? Reish Lamed, those two letters stand for Ratzel Omar, means to say, She'ein Yad Ha'umos Tekefa Aleinu. When the other nations are not sovereign on us. Ein Meta'anin Bahem Afilu Metoras Rishus. You're not allowed to fast on those days, even as an option. Meaning it's prohibited to fast on those days. Shaharei ne'emar, v'hem yu leves Yehuda l'sason u'simcha. Because it says it'll be sason and simcha. So according to Rashi and the Meiri, it seems that nowadays, Presumably, Tisha B'Av and the rest of the fast days would no longer be fast days. There are people that argue that even according to Rashi, it would still be a fast day today because Israel is still dependent upon non-Jewish aid, upon foreign aid. So because they're dependent on foreign aid, according to some people, Rashi and the Meiri would still say that it's a fast day because really Jews are not completely sovereign since they're still dependent on some non-Jewish help. But the simple readings of Rashi and the Meiri, it seems to me, without that addendum, the simple reading seems to me that when Jews are sovereign in the land of Israel, there is no fasting. Presumably, those academics that drank Alachayim at the Western Wall were going on this Rashi. Unfortunately, however, that Rashi is not the interpretation of the Gemara that was accepted halachically. The interpretation that was accepted is that of the Sephardic Rishonim, beginning with the Ramban, but stated most clearly by the Ritva on page 3. The Ritva writes, Ella Amru, ki bizman shiyesh shalom. Here comes the kicker. Bizman shiyesh shalom, in a time that there is peace, klomar, meaning, sheyisrael shruyin al admasam, when the Jews live in their land, u Veis HaMikdash Kayam, and the temple stands. Yihyu L'Sason U'L'Simcha. That's the time that is considered Shalom, according to the Ritva and the Ramban, and those who follow that tradition, which is the majority of the Rishonim, virtually all of them except for Rashi and the Meiri. I knew I'd get you all excited by that Rashi and Meiri, so I told you them first. According to the Ritva, there are two qualifications for what is considered shalom. One, that the Jews live in Israel. And two, that the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, stands. So according to that, no go. Still not a time of peace right now. What about that middle section, though? Where it's not a time of peace, and it's not a time of gzeirat malchut. So I will tell you that is what most of the poskim consider now. Neither a time of peace, nor a time of gzeirat malchut. And so according to most of the poskim, Tisha B'Av is still an obligatory fast, as per the Gemara that we read on page 1. But technically, on a halachic level, the other three fasts are optional. Asara B'Teves, Tzom Gedalia, and Shiva Asar B'Tamuz. On a technical halachic level, they are optional fasts. Ratzu Mita'anin, Ratzu Ein Mita'anin. That's what the Gemara said. The Rishonim have already noted that despite the fact that that would actually be the din, that's the halachic rule, the minhag is that we all fast. So it is betoras minhag. I didn't include these sources because we were getting a little heavy on the Hebrew sources. So the Rambam writes that there is a minhag to fast on all the fast days, and the commentaries on the Rambam note that the Rambam specifically wrote that it's a minhag. He specifically wrote that it's a minhag because of what we've been saying. According to the actual halacha, it ought to have been optional to fast on the three minor fasts associated with the destruction. However, there has become a strong minhag for everyone to fast despite the fact that it's optional. The reason I point this out, by the way, is that at least in downstate, it's sort of like a... That's sort of like the marker between the really frum people and the sort of regular modern Orthodox people, who fasts on the minor fasts. Because not every fast on the Shiva Sarbat Tammuz and Asara B'Teves and all that, many people don't fast. So that's sort of the marker. But my point with this is just that they actually have a leg to stand on. It's not as serious of a marker as one might have imagined. And the second thing is that the rules that apply to those minor fasts should be the ones that apply to a minhag and not to a rule of a derabanan, certainly not a doraisa, but not even a derabanan. They are on the level of minhag because right now is neither shalom nor gzeras malchus. And so really those three minor fasts specifically have the rules of a minhag, of a custom. One question which arises as to what exactly would warrant canceling fasting on Tisha B'Av is a historical question. Artie? So the historical question is, what did the Jews do in the days of the Second Temple? Because Tisha B'Av was instituted after the destruction of the First Temple. So did they fast in the days of the Second Temple? What do you guys think? Who thinks no? Who thinks yes? Okay. What if I told you it's a machlokas rishonim? It's always the answer.
You're all right.
You're all right, exactly. My high school students, I taught Ramaz in the high school in New York before I came here. And I always told them that the answer is always the machlokas. That's always the answer.
You always get 100.
That's right. But actually, the majority of interpretations seem to say that they did fast in the days of the Second Temple. Take a look on page 4 at the Rambam. You might need a magnifying glass for this. It's a little small. It's very small. It was an understatement. This is the Rambam in his commentary on the Mishnah, which he wrote when he was in his early 20s, so we all have something to aspire to. Okay. V'vayis sheni, lo hayu mit'anin, lo asara b'teves, v'lo shiva asar b'tamuz, ela misha yarotze mit'ane, in the days of the Second Temple, they didn't fast on the minor fasts, unless they wanted to. Some people wanted to, and so they fasted. By the way, this seems to go against what we had read earlier, that if there is shalom, then you're not allowed to fast on those days. It's kind of strange. The commentaries attack the Rambam on this, especially the ones that believe that they didn't fast on Tisha B'Av in the days of the Second Temple. They go to town on that comment. Okay. He then notes, Afal pi shehaya harishus ve'adam shelo lehit anos betisha be'av kmo shezacharnu. Even though they had the permission to not fast, to eat on Tisha B'Av, as we have discussed, hayu meta'anin bo mipnei tchifas minei ha'avel shir'u bo. They still fasted on that day, because of all the different kinds of mourning that took place on Tisha B'Av, as we will discuss later, as we will discuss in Masechet Ta'anit. And so according to the Rambam and most of the Rishonim, the Jews in the Second Temple period did continue to fast on Tisha B'Av. On purely halachic grounds, nowadays, despite the fact that Yerushalayim has been recaptured, and we have sovereignty over it, you can debate the level of that sovereignty. But despite that fact, nowadays, halachically, Tisha B'Av still remains a fast. And again, we discussed the status of the other three minor fasts. There's good evidence for the Rambam in the Mishnah itself, by the way. Look on page 5. Al shisha chodashim ashluchin yotzin. The Mishnah says that the emissaries of the court observe the new month on 6 different months. Al Nisan mipnei Pesach. They observe Nisan because you have to know when Pesach is. That's why they would go, you know, in the olden days, they didn't have a set calendar like we do. They had a calendar that was dependent on emissaries of the court going out and seeing whether or not there'd be a new month. And so they would do that when it was necessary. So you have to know when Nisan is, because you have to know when Pesach is. Al Av mipnei ha-ta'anis. They would go to see the month of Av because of the fast. And this was true even in the Second Temple. We know they did this, even in the Second Temple. They would send emissaries out to observe when the new month was because of the fast. The rest of the Mishnah lists the other months that have a special holiday in them, and therefore warranted observing that new month. And so, it's clear that they did fast in the time of the Second Temple. Rav Kook has a wonderful letter about this on page 6. This is in a letter that Rav Kook wrote when Herbert Samuel was placed as the governor of Palestine in the British Mandate, the mandatory government. It's called the governor, they called him a governor? Minister? The mandatory governor, right. So when Herbert Samuel was placed as the mandatory governor, was the first time in a long time that a Jew was actually at some level the sovereign over the land of Israel. And someone wrote a letter to Rav Kook asking whether they could now cancel some of the fasts because now there is a Jew who is sovereign over the land. And that's what we read in the Rashi and the Meiri. I mean, a simple Jew who learns Daf Yomi sees the Gemara and sees Rashi. They didn't see the Ritva. So they say, you know, they didn't necessarily see the Shulchan Aruch. They see Shalom means that a Jew is sovereign over the land of Israel. Michtavo hayakar kibalti. V'ragashot sheshonu b'tshuat Hashem asher iflila asot imanu. B'yesod geulatenu b'minuyav ha'elyon shelachinu asar agadol shlita. I received your letter. And we certainly feel many different feelings about the miracles that God has done for us. With regards to the appointment of this minister, may he live a long life. Mal'at levavi, simchat lev. My heart was full of joy. Beroti ki gam zekeinei hador, margishim v'chashim et or ha'yeshua. V'zehu siman yafeh levet Yisrael u'tichiyato. And I was so happy that even the elders, meaning the old rabbis, not just the young rabbis like me, he was young, but even the older rabbis, feel the light of redemption coming. And this is a good sign for our people. Umnam, however. It's always good when there's a however. B'mashin ogel is sgulat hatzomot. With regards to the fast, Choshevani ki ad asher yechonen Hashem et beit mikdashenu hacharev le'inenu. I think that until God brings back the temple, which is desolate right now, behar marom harim, on the temple mount, latiferet le'inei kol ha'amim, as a splendor in the eyes of all the people, if shalanu levatel otam, we cannot cancel them. Unekave ki ka'asher and we hope that now, since Israel, that the God of Israel has begun our redemption, with regards to our general redemption, about the Holy Land in general, so too shall God shine the light upon the rebuilding of our temple. V'yishlach lenu Mashiach tzidkenu b'geulah shleima. And may he send us our Messiah with full redemption. Lo shia et kol am Hashem anidachim bein ze'evei arev. To bring back all of the people of God who are spread out among the wolves of the night. Shedamam holech v'nishpach ba'avonoteinu ba'avonot harabim. Whose blood is spilled on account of our sins. Gam ka'et be'ofen orav v'ayom. Even today, their blood is still spilled. And so you see, he then goes on in the next paragraph to say, that when God finally shines his full redemption upon us, and the Beis HaMikdash is built, that is when the fasts will turn into Sason v'Simcha. Echoing again what we've been saying all along, but saying it first of all, saying it in a historically significant time. Artie.
It seems to me that, maybe I'm anticipating where you're going with this, but if they continued to fast during the Second Temple period, would we not mimic that example in a Third Temple period?
So it's a great question. It's not where I'm going with it,
okay.
But I'll entertain the question. It's a great question. And so that's what the commentaries all attack. First of all, the Rambam said that they didn't have to fast. They chose to fast. That's the first thing. And the second thing, the other commentaries that disagree with the Rambam say, how could they fast when there's a second temple? What is Sason v'Simcha if not that? And so it's a question, the answer to which I don't know. Right. I don't know. I mean, again, it's a lot of speculation because Rambam lived, over 1,000 years after the Second Temple was destroyed. So, I don't really know. No.
The Second Temple was lacking some of the things that they had in the first place of Israel.
Right.
There's still something greater than they were hoping for. That they didn't realize that they had it, basically, it wasn't the full thing.
That's true.
So, the will be, though.
To reiterate, right. So just to reiterate that there were certain korbanot, certain things missing in the first Beit HaMikdash, in the second Beit HaMikdash, that still left something missing to allow for that fast. And that's probably what the Rambam is referring to. Paul.
So two questions: did Jews fast during the first Temple period, and did they fast even before the Temple was even built?
No, they did not. The fast was instituted in the aftermath of the destruction of the first temple. Amy?
Yeah, two sort of thoughts. One is, the line's always going to be moving out.
And what do you mean?
It's never going to be good enough, ever again. It's always going to be this anticipation of something else.
That's what Yishayahu Leibovitch, who was an important Jewish philosopher in Israel, really a professor of physics, but beyond that, he wrote a lot of Jewish philosophy. So he always said that part of Judaism, this was not accepted by Orthodox theology, but just what he said is that HaMashiach Yavo, that's his inflection. HaMashiach Yavo, that's how he used to say it. And that's part of the essence of what Mashiach is. Mashiach will come. And that any other Mashiach is a false Mashiach. But obviously that was not accepted. We believe that a Mashiach will come. Rabbi.
But there's enough of a reason to imagine that's why the Tzilat Nachem has undergone, at least in view, by some of those who lived through the Six-Day War and beyond.
That's correct. So I'll mention that. I personally omit one line from the Tefillah of Nachem in line with what Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zecher Tzadik Livracha also did. The tefillah is actually funny. It's a debate between the Sephardic and Ashkenazi chief rabbinate of Israel. When Rav Goren and Rav Avadi Yosef were the chief rabbis, they debated removing parts of Nachem or changing the words of Nachem. Because the words of Nachem say that Yerushalayim is desolate, nobody lives there, and so on and so forth. And that's just not true. So how can we continue saying Nachem if it's not true? So Rav Gorin wanted to change the tefillah, and Rav Avadi Yosef said, absolutely not, you don't change the tefillah. I later discovered that the reason for that debate is that the Sephardic Nachem and the Ashkenazi Nachem are different. And the Sephardi Nachem the Ashkenazi Nachem has a line in it that is much more extreme than the Sephardic version does. And so Rav Aaron Lichtenstein suggested simply omitting that one line. I forget the line right now, but it's in the Nachem. It's one that specifically, explicitly says that it is that Yerushalayim is desolate and nobody lives there. Right. It's clearly not true. Okay. In the next 15 minutes or so, and right now we sort of outline the halachic reason why Tisha B'Av is still a fast day. Notwithstanding that, there are many, many Orthodox Jews who fast on Tisha B'Av, but don't really experience or feel the fast. People even here, just in my 2 weeks here, said to me, you know, Rabbi Tisha B'Av is the hardest day for me because I fast, because you have to fast, but I don't really feel it. I visit Yerushalayim all the time, and I don't feel that sense of longing. So I'd like to present a more philosophical approach based on Rav Soloveitchik's view of time, but one which I think will add a layer to our experience of Tisha B'Av. Rav Soloveitchik, in many of his lectures, discussed something that he called halachic time consciousness. And that is to be contrasted with standard linear time. He says it explicitly in philosophical terms in Halachic Man, but then we're going to read it in less philosophical terms, more homiletic terms, I guess, in other works. So, page 7, Halachic Man. Just a little bit on the Rav's philosophy. The Rav writes his philosophy in philosophical terms almost in its entirety in 3 books. In Halachic Mind, Halachic Man, and a little bit in The Lonely Man of Faith as well. And much of the Rav's philosophy can be found in those 3 works. And many of the other works are manifestations of the philosophies that he explains in those works. So you'll see that right over here. There's a past and there's a future that are connected with one another and with the present only through the law of causality. The cause found at moment A links up with the effect taking place at moment B, and so on. However, time itself as past appears only as no more, and future appears as not yet. That's regular time, linear time. One thing follows another thing. Skip to the next arrow. However, there is a past that persists in its existence, that does not vanish and disappear, but remains firm in its place. Such a past enters into the domain of the present and links up with the future. So the past continues to exist. Not that we've passed the past. The past continues to linger and links up with the present. Similarly, there is a future that is not hidden behind a thick cloud, but reveals itself now in all its beauty and majesty. Such a future, drawing upon its own hidden roots, infuses the past with strength and might, vigor and vitality. Both past and future are alive. Both act and create in the heart of the present and shape the very image of reality. From this perspective, we neither perceive the past as no more, nor the future as not yet, nor the present as just a fleeting moment in between the two. Rather, past, present, and future merge and blend together. And this new threefold time structure arises before us, adorned with a splendid unity. The past is joined to the future, and both are reflected in the present. What does that mean?
Can you give us an example?
I'm going to. So, in Halach Man, he goes on to explain that that's how tshuva works. And I'm quite certain that I'll refer back to this in about a month. It's in about a month.
In the future.
In the future. But it's now. See, this is we're living it right now. But Rav Soloveitchik says that tshuva is taking our past and re-envisioning it by our future. The best way, I think, to describe it in practical terms, I mean, this is very philosophical, and it talks about, you know, you can argue whether he's talking in the realm of metaphysics or in the realm of ethics, but it's esoteric, nonetheless. But in tshuva, I think a good example of this is someone who had, you know, drug or alcohol problems in the past. And in the past, he looks back on that past as a difficult time in his life and as a tragic time in his life. But this same individual, 20 years down the line, opens up a rehabilitation facility where he is in a unique position to help those who are now facing the very same struggles he faced years ago. Now, what he's doing with his experience is effectively doing a lot of good in the world. And he would not have been able to do it were it not for that past experience. He took the past experience, which was tragic and difficult at that time, but he transformed it into a new reality and completely changes this individual's biography, because the biography before he opened the rehabilitation facility was one kind of biography. He had a difficult time in the past, and now he's doing okay. But now the biography has a different teleology. The biography is written in such a way that this individual, you know, had these troubles, and that's what led him to do exactly what he does now. And so it's the way in which the future can actually change the story of the past. That's what Rav Soloveitchik is saying. That the past is not something that we've just gone by and, you know, it doesn't exist anymore. The past is still alive because future events can still shape the past. Yeah.
But is that the linear method that point A leads to point B?
No, because in the linear method, point B comes after point A, and has and point A is no more. The difference is that it's not just that he experienced something and then, you know, then went on to open up a rehabilitation facility. The idea is that now his entire biography is different. And when you read, when now the biographer comes and writes about his troubled youth, it's now written in completely different language and with different terms, because now it's part of a bigger picture.
With somebody who converts to Judaism, you're not supposed to, my understanding is, you're not supposed to refer to their past at all. You know, it's not right to do that.
Right, well,
bring it up.
Right. I don't want to talk about tshuva right now because I'm going to save. We'll talk about this in about a month, I promise.
Okay.
We'll get back to this theme in about a month. And all of you will be in a better position to, you know, to appreciate what we talk about in about a month. Yes, Steve.
Are you suggesting causality? In other words, his past is what created the opportunity for.
I'm suggesting the opposite.
So look at the opposite. So let's look at a different outcome. Let's say he killed himself from an overdose. So the exact same person. One survived and opened up a rehab facility and did what he did. Same other individual, same timeline and all the rest, died. So how are you going to relate back how are those two distinct outcomes going to relate, is time-wise, back to what happened when he was in that?
I'm not sure the example is good enough. Okay.
Okay.
But the point is that it's not that the past causes the future. In this, what the Rav is saying, everybody knows the past can cause the future. What the Rav is saying is the future can change the past. That's what he's saying. What? Okay, but that's the difference between understanding whether you're talking about metaphysics or ethics. We're not, I don't want to get into that. Very philosophical. Let's get to the practical example on page 8. Page 8, the Rav uses the same idea. This is from a Haggadah, which includes the Rav's ideas. While everything exists in time, only the human being is capable of experiencing time. By the way, philosophers and historians don't get along. You know? Yeah, I know that. What do you think, Artie?
Did you say early
something? That's what
synopsis
is for.
Huh?
That's what a good synopsis is for.
That's right. While everything exists in time, only the human being is capable of experiencing time. God endowed man with time awareness, the ability to sense and feel time, and the existential stream of selfhood. This time awareness or experience has three basic component parts. First, retrospection. Without memory, there is no time. Second, the time experience includes exploration or close examination of things yet unborn and events not yet in existence. This means the anticipatory experience of events not yet in being. Third is appreciation or evaluation of the present moment as one's most precious possession. No one is worthy of time awareness if retrospection is alien to him, if he is incapable of reliving, recovering, and reproducing past experiences. Indeed, the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, the commandment of telling the story of the Exodus, does not exhaust itself in a historic review of bygone events that have vanished completely. Okay? It's not just telling the story of things that are gone. It is more than that. It is a drama charged with emotion and tenseness, participating in the past. Past events, which are not re-experienced, belong not to history but to archaeology. Archaeology involves past events that occurred once upon a time, disappeared, and, while they may be reproduced by memory, are not alive anymore. They are not re-experienced. There is no retrospection of the archaic. Memory is not just a storehouse for latent impressions. There is also the living memory, which reproduces and re-experiences the past. On the left, the Judaic philosophy of time comes to expression in the text of Kiddush. In physics, time is quantified, measured by the clock. But pure time, real time, cannot be quantified. It is pure quality. With Kiddush, we sanctify time and endow it with creativity and meaning. It is the first thing we do as free people at the Seder. So again, he says, there's the physician's view of time, a clock, but real time is the quality of time, what that time becomes. You know, I can best explain this as there are some experiences we've had that may have lasted days, but we barely remember them. Well, you might have another experience that lasted 45 seconds, but we remember that vividly. And that takes up a larger portion of our time, our human time. That's what he's referring to. Okay. On the next two pages, I've included passages from Kol Dodi Dofek, where the Rav applies the same idea, the same basic principle to fate and destiny, to our experience of evil in the world. The Rav says that we experience evil, and Judaism acknowledges evil. Judaism does not believe that we don't think that evil exists in the world, even though there were some Jewish philosophers that tried to say there was no such thing as evil in the world. But the Rav says that Judaism does not believe that. There is evil. And an existence of fate is one that just takes the evil as it is and, you know, tries to figure it out and is tormented by it. And that's an existence that we all have. We all live on a level of fate. We all live on a level of physician's time. Physicist's time, sorry. Physician's time is 15 minutes. We all live in the world of physicist's time. But that's the existence of fate. But the existence of destiny is what we do with those experiences. That's the Rav's whole idea in Kol Dodi Dofek, is that the state of Israel came out of the Holocaust. God forbid, he would never say that the Holocaust happened so that the state of Israel could be founded. That is not what he says. What he says is that the Holocaust, the Shoah, was a terrible tragedy. But the Jews looked at it and said, what can we do from this to turn the effects of this tragedy and make something productive out of it? And that the result of that is the state of Israel. I think that all of these ideas, and by the way, that's how the future, right, changes the story of the past. Nobody's going to write a book on the history of the Holocaust without including the founding of the state of Israel. I think that we can take all of these basic ideas about halachic time consciousness, I think they also apply to Tisha B'Av. We're not mourning something that took place 2,500 years ago or 2,000 years ago. But rather, we are all re-experiencing mourning something that has just happened. We are all sitting Shiva. I think that Batya said it very nicely this morning, taking the Avelut Yeshana and making it into the feeling of an Avelut Chadasha. In the same way that we celebrate Pesach by reenacting what free people do, by reenacting that freedom. We celebrate something that happened thousands of years ago, but we're not supposed to view it as some historical event that happened thousands of years ago, but rather we're supposed to reenact it so that we feel like it's happening to us. Tisha B'Av is the same thing, but the opposite. Tisha B'Av is something where we feel the destruction of the temple, and we're supposed to experience that within us. And that lasts even to this day, so long as the temple does not exist. And I think that it is a way of relating to Tisha B'Av which remains relevant even post the Six-Day War. Thank you very much, and I hope you have an easy and meaningful rest of the fast.